Second.
We're recording as well.
Okay, perfect. All right. For the record, it's March 10th, 2026, 1 o'clock p.m. We're here on the City of Bainbridge Island, Janaul SEPA, Appeal of Ordinance Number 2025-21. At the request of the appellant, we're doing oral argument on the city's motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. The hearing format for that is we or I should say argument format for that is Mr. Selmy, on behalf of the city, will present the city's argument, then we give the appellant a chance to respond, and then the city has a chance to rebut. Any preliminary matters before we jump into it, or
No, Mr.
okay.
Examiner.
Sounds good. All right, Mr. Selmy, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Examiner. So, as you previously noted, the sole issue before the hearing examiner today is whether this hearing examiner has subject matter jurisdiction to even hear this appeal. All other facts and argument that do not pertain to the issue of subject matter jurisdiction are relevant and should be disregarded. The primary reasons for why this motion should be hyper-focused on subject matter jurisdiction is, again, first, that is what is before the hearing examiner. But second, and most importantly, as the hearing examiner previously noted, if the hearing examiner lacks subject matter jurisdiction, then the only permissible action that the hearing examiner may take is to dismiss this appeal. So put another way, if there is no subject matter jurisdiction, nothing else matters. So, with that setting the table, I'll jump right into it. So, as noted in the pleadings, the city is relying upon a state statute, specifically RCW 43.21C.495, subsection 4. And I think it's a little helpful to maybe start with kind of the statute in general. 43.21C.495 was actually initially enacted in 2019 as part of ESS HB 1923. And at that time, it just had one subsection, or actually didn't even have subsections. And the purpose was, as part of ESS HB 1923, which was designed to increase urban dense residential building capacity, it built out this ex provision, which is now in 495, which exempted from SEPA appeals, both administrative and judicial. Amendments to development regulations and other non-project actions taken by a city to implement requirements to meet that requirement of urban residential capacity. Since 2019, the state legislature has introduced, as I'm sure you know, a flurry of bills to increase housing within the state. And as in doing so throughout the course, the state legislature has slowly added various provisions to 495, including subsection 4, which is at issue here. And in subsection 4, it clearly states adoption of ordinances, development regulations, and amendments to such regulations, and other non-project actions by a city or county to implement the housing element requirements set forth in RCW 3670A-0702 are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter. So kind of building in that same vein of the state legislature really prioritizing increasing urban capacity by allowing or by prohibiting appeal or SEPA appeals of non-project actions to implement that. They've done the same here for implementing the housing element. So with this language in mind, the next question then is whether RCW 43.21C4 applies here. And if you read that specific subsection, another way to put it is kind of two separate questions, and I'll address it in two separate questions. The first is proposed ordinance 2521 a non-project action? That specific term. And the second is, if so, does that non-project action implement the housing requirements set forth in RCW 3670A-070 subsection 2? So I'll take those questions one by one, but I'll kind of start in reverse order and start with the question of, does the proposed ordinance implement the housing requirements set forth in 3670-0702? Now, notably, the appellant's response doesn't appear to contest this point, but for the sake of thoroughness, I'll go ahead and address it nevertheless. So, in general, RCW 3670A-070 establishes the mandatory requirements for elements of a comprehensive plan. And subsection 2, which is quite lengthy, relates to housing. And subsection 2D says a housing element ensuring the vitality and character of established residential neighborhoods, that subsection D, makes adequate provisions for existing and projected needs of all economic segments of the community, including incorporating consideration for low, very low, extremely low, and moderate income households, and so forth. I won't go on, but there's a lot more to that statute. Now, while the city's current comprehensive plan is still in need of updating, the city's current comprehensive plan still does establish various policies and goals to make provisions for existing and projected needs of all economic segments of the community. As noted in the city's briefing, there's a lot of these policies and goals. This includes goal HO-1, which requires the city to make steady progress towards following aspirational targets for increasing the diversity of housing types and the supply of affordable housing. Goal HO-4, increase the supply of permanent affordable multifamily housing each year through year 2036, and so forth. Policy HO-4.2, revise development standards for the High School Road and Ferry Terminal districts and other portions of the Winslow Area Master Plan to encourage transformation of these areas from auto-oriented, low-rise, homogeneous commercial land use districts into walkable, transit-served, mid-rise, mixed use with affordable housing. Policy HO-4.5, remove barriers from the creation of new multifamily housing, particularly affordable housing, through a variety of actions. And goal HO-6, facilitate the provision of diverse affordable housing stock in all geographic areas of the community. So with these goals in mind, and furtherance of these goals, the proposed ordinance 2521 makes various changes to development regulations for affordable housing, obviously in a clear effort to incentivize development. 100% affordable housing is housing for economic segments who are typically below your typical household income, i.e., households that may be low, very low, extremely low, and or moderate income households. So I think the answer to the second question is obviously yes. So now let's jump into it about the first question. The first question is a little bit more involved, which is kind of why I'm addressing it second. The second question is proposed ordinance 2521 a quote unquote non-project action? And this is kind of where we get into the weeds a little bit. So, typical, practices when you're trying to look for a defined term, you obviously look to the source. And that is, we'll start with RCW chapter 43.21c, which unfortunately doesn't define non-project actions. So therefore, we then turn to the CEPA rules, WAC 197.11, chapter 197.11 for the definitions. Now, the CEPA rules don't define the term specifically, non-project space action. But we can use the find that definition if you apply those terms separately. First non-project, then action. So WAC 197.11-774 defines non-project as actions which are different or broader than a single site-specific project, such as plans, policies, and programs. WAC 197 of 704 sub 1 then states actions include legislative proposals. And WAC 197.11.784 defines a proposal to mean a proposed action. A proposal includes both actions and regulatory decisions of agencies, as well as any actions proposed by applicants. So when you put that all together, all these different definitions, you reach the conclusion that a non-project action can include, it's not definitively, it's not mutually exclusive, but can include legislative proposed action that is broader than a single site specific project. Proposed Ordinance 2521 is a legislative proposed action, and it is broader than a single site specific project. Therefore, our proposed Ordinance 2521 is a non-project action. Despite these clear definitions, the appellant kind of throws a couple of arguments to kind of undercut this, or at least an attempt to undercut this. And one is the citation to WAC 197.11.704b1 to kind of stand for the proposition that adopted ordinances don't qualify as, proposed ordinances don't qualify as non-project actions. This is not true because, again, the clear definitions established in the CEPA rules run contrary to this position, as I just previously stated. And the plain language of 197.11.704B does not indicate that proposed ordinances do not qualify as non-project actions. And this is further confirmed by the fact that 197.11.704(1)(c) clearly states that legislative proposals are actions. I think that's clear as day. If legislative proposals or legislative proposals cannot be project-based actions, therefore they must be what? Non-project actions. Furthermore, though, even if the appellant is correct and that a proposed ordinance requires some sort of underlying decision, there is such an underlying decision here in the form of the council's motion, as mentioned in the city's brief. And that is, council adopted a motion that stated the city to direct the city manager to direct city staff to come back with the tightest code change that makes sense to allow additional FAR for 100% affordable housing to facilitate, and I'm going to insert words here, the 65 Winslow Affordable Housing Project. The testimony presented thus far has been that city staff prepare Ordinance 2521 at council direction and within those parameters in mind before conducting CEPA review. So even if the appellant's interpretation is applied, I think there's still a underlying decision here. The appellant also separately asserts that under Magnolia, proposed ordinance 2521 somehow loses its non-project status when a court determines that it is actually a decision on a site-specific construction project in a defined geographic area. And as a result of the appellant then reasons that, look, that the DNS for proposed ordinance 2521 is therefore a non-project action. But if you read Magnolia, I think that's an extremely strange interpretation of that case. Because Magnolia includes very specific facts. And that specifically involves a situation where the city of Seattle was required to build a project upon approval of the non-project action. Here, no one is required to build any kind of project whatsoever if the proposed ordinance 2521 were to be adopted. Appellant also relies separately on WAC 197.11-0603B to argue that the proposed ordinance and the 65 project should have been evaluated in the city's CEPA review. And as a result, the appellant then reasons that the DNS for proposed ordinance is therefore not a non-project action, and therefore 495 sub 4 doesn't apply. WAC 197.11-0603B specifically defines when proposals must be discussed in the same environmental document. It is when, one, they cannot or will not proceed unless the other proposal or parts of proposals are implemented simultaneously with them, or two, when they are interdependent parts of a larger proposal and depend on the larger proposal as their justification or for their implementation. Now, the appellant doesn't appear to contend that 197.11.060.3b.1 applies, seems to suggest that only 3b.2 applies, so we'll only address that. Proposed Ordinance 2521 and the 65 project aren't independent parts, and that's why this doesn't apply. Interdependent is being the key word here, excuse me. That's kind of what I want to focus the hearing examiner on. Excuse me. Interdependent is not defined within the CEPA rules. It's not defined within 4321C. So relying upon a basic dictionary definition of interdependent generally means it must be dependent on one another. So A must be dependent on B. B must be dependent on A. There must be kind of inverse relationships. Now, the 625 project is not dependent necessarily on the proposed ordinance. Yes, the proposed ordinance may facilitate its construction by allowing Lehigh to build a project that it hopes to build, but in theory, that 625 project can be built without the ordinance if the parameters of the project are simply changed, which, as the hearing examiner has heard throughout the course of this hearing, can happen. We've seen different iterations of the proposal throughout the timeline, 70 units, 90 units, different heights. So the project can still move forward without the ordinance. We'll just simply have to change. But most glaringly, though, with this interdependence argument, is that proposed Ordinance 2521 is not dependent on the 65 project. The city can adopt the proposed ordinance without the 65 project moving forward. Therefore, by the basic definition of interdependence, there's no interdependence here. Second, proposed Ordinance 2521 and 65 project are also not a part of the larger proposal, right? You got to remember, under subsection 3b2, it requires interdependent parts of a larger proposal. Now, the city contends here, and as we've seen throughout the course of this hearing, that yes, the ordinance is pretty clear. The parameters of the ordinance are very clear, but the 65 project is still very nebulous. A lot has still yet to be determined. We have no project permits here. We have no guarantees about exactly what this project will look like. So it is almost impossible to define that, based on how you define proposal as a proposal. And even if we were to define it as a proposal, how is the city supposed to conduct meaningful environmental review on a moving target? The city can, try to do environmental review on the latest iteration of what Lehigh says the 65 project may be, but that could absolutely change the next day. So, with all that in mind, Mr. Examiner, 4321C 4954 is pretty clear here. You'll look at the legislative history here, and that kind of really kind of furthers the city argument. And that is the state legislature has said that has prioritized housing. And that if we are going to be implementing, has dictated that CEPA appeals of non-project actions in furtherance of this housing are exempt from CEPA review because housing is that important. In this particular case, the proposed ordinance 2521 furthers the housing element requirements of 0702 by encouraging affordable housing. Therefore, as a result, the hearing examiner lacks subject matter jurisdiction under 4321C 495, subsection 4.
Okay, just one question for you. I'm going to put up that statute you've been citing, the one that issue here, 4321C 495. And one of the major points you're making is that the ordinance is a non-project action, which I guess appears to concede the point that it has to qualify as a non-project action. And I'm not sure that the or that 4321C 495 requires that. If you look at the language, it's subsection 4, it says that no judicial appeals applied require.
Mr. Examiner, are you still there?
Of ordinances, development regulations, and amendments implement the housing element. Point, the ordinance has to qualify as a non-project action because the way I see it is that if you're an ordinance, development regulation, or amendment thereto, you're automatically subject to this. And also, if you also happen to be non-project action that implements that otherwise implements the housing element, those also are subject to that exemption.
Mr. Examiner, you had broken up there for about 30 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. All right. Let me repeat that then, Mr. Soling. Yeah, I'm just and let me know if I'm still breaking up. I'm just wondering if the city is conceding the point that this ordinance has to qualify as non-project ordinance to qualify for that exemption from appeals, because it don't necessarily have to be to interpret it that way, right? Because it says subsection 4 says that the actions exempt from appeals are adoption of ordinances, development regulations, amendments to those regulations, and other non-project actions. So I guess I'm trying to figure out why is the city just assuming that it has to be that the ordinance themselves have to be non-project actions?
That's an interesting question, Mr. Examiner. Could you kind of explain a little bit your rationale? You read subsection 4, but I kind of want to better understand your question. Could you explain?
Well, like I said, I mean, you focused your primary argument on the fact that the ordinance doesn't that the city is well, the ordinance under review is a non-project action, and I'm just wondering if you even need to go that far because I don't. I if one reading of 4321C 495 is that any ordinance that implements the housing element is not subject to the its SEPA appeal isn't subject to appeal. But like I said, you haven't made that argument. You've just jumped to the point that it's a non-project action.
That's an interesting point, Mr. Examiner. I think quite frankly, the most reasonable interpretation of this particular statute is that it applies to adoption of ordinances. That's one. Adoption of development regulations. That's two. Adoption of amendments to development regulations. And number four, non-project actions. I think it's pretty clear here that we haven't reached adoption of an ordinance. It's not adoption of a development regulation. It's not an adoption of an amendment to a development regulation. I think it's absolutely a non-project action. But if the hearing examiner believes, obviously, that simply an ordinance in of itself qualifies as subsection four, I think that is a reasonable interpretation. I just feel that the most reasonable of those interpretations is, as I just stated.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and this is kind of a point I think that I was going to raise with the appellant is this statute doesn't deal with appeals of ordinances. It deals with judicial appeals under this chapter at the end, which means with the SEPA review associated with that ordinance. I mean, the way I read this is we're talking about the ordinance here. And the section applies to the SEPA review associated with the adoption of that
I see.
ordinance.
I see.
Isn't I mean,
Well,
isn't that what it's all about? And so
that also makes that's an excellent point, and I quite frankly didn't consider that, but I think then now you've outlined yet another reason why perhaps 4954 applies. So.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious about it. Okay, thank you, Mr. Selling. All right, let's jump to Mr. Telligen. Mr. Telligen, go ahead.
Would you mind taking your screen sharing off, Mr. Examiner?
Oh, sure, yeah. Get that off for you. There you go.
I just sent a request to share my own screen. Can you see my screen, Mr. Examiner?
Yeah.
Very good. So I just had a brief synopsis here on the first page, timing of the city's new motion to dismiss. I wanted to highlight a couple things. So this motion comes 6.5 months after the city issued the DNS, stated in the DNS that it was appealable to the city's hearing examiner and took Ms. Jano's $535 filing fee. 5 months after the city filed its first motion to dismiss, which was denied after extensive briefing. 3.5 months after the examiner denied that motion, 2 months after the hearing was originally set to begin, the city later asked for a month-long extension to prepare its case. A month after the first of 5 full hearing days, 1 month after the city's attorney asked for my client to pay the city employees for their time to be at this hearing, 2 weeks after Ms. Jano filed her motion for summary for motion as a judgment of a matter of law based on the fact that the checklist was not prepared until after the threshold determination was made, 6 days after oral argument on that motion, and 4 days before you were scheduled to rule on this motion. I think the question is, why is it coming so late? And my answer is that because the rule that they're relying upon doesn't quite fit the facts of this case. They're trying to put a square peg into a round hole, as it were. Now, to your point about the law at issue in the city's motion, RCW 4321C 495, I agree with Mr. Soeming that there's, sort of four subsections. It's the adoption of ordinances, the amendment of regulations, and other non-project actions. And I agree with you that, yeah, it's the SEPA review that goes along with those. And I'll get to the sort of the point about where that SEPA review fits in. But I think I agree with Mr. Soeming that the first question is, does Ordinance 2025-21 implement the city's housing element? Because go back here, the statute says, it asks, does the ordinance implement the housing element requirements set forth in RCW 3678-072? And the way the city has pitched it in this motion, I think this is right, is you have to ask the question, well, the city has actually adopted those housing elements as part of its comprehensive plan. And so you have to ask the question, does the ordinance actually implement those housing elements that the city has adopted? And I have here an excerpt from the city's brief where it sort of lays out all the housing elements in its comprehensive plan that implement 3670A0702. And they say, well, we implement all these things, therefore it must be the case. And you see in the footnote I have highlighted here, they say, according to the stipulated testimony of Jennifer Sutton, or in this 2025-21 is consistent with all these things. And I have here, it's at the motion to dismiss page six, but I have a but see response at five note four, because I pointed out we didn't stipulate to that. What we stipulated is what was that when Mr. Soeming was having Ms. Sutton read every element of the comprehensive plan, I stipulated that I would stipulate, and I agree that she believes those things. She believes that it is consistent with the comprehensive plan, but the city hasn't actually demonstrated that. And I think one thing in particular is the answer is no, the ordinance does not implement the comprehensive plan housing element. Because if you look at the comprehensive plan housing element, this is from City Exhibit 16. This is a copy of their existing housing element that they have adopted pursuant to RCW 3670A070. It actually has a section on implementation, on how those elements will be implemented. And it's in one of those housing actions is to partner with other jurisdictions, the development community, and nonprofit organizations to increase the diversity of housing types and supply of affordable housing. But this ordinance is being passed specifically to enable a project on a very specific piece of property, and a very specific piece of property that's owned by the city, part of which they've had for a long time, part of which they purchased or they condemned specifically for this property. And now they're going to use their own property for this project. And there is an actual policy on that. And the policy says, HO 9.5, it says, consider the options for making city-owned land and or airspace available through long-term leases, which is what they're proposing to do here, or other mechanisms for the purpose of creating income-qualified housing and support other public entities that wish to use publicly owned land for this purpose. But then it goes on to say, take into consideration, however, the full range of uses that city-owned properties may serve over the long term. So what the comprehensive plan is telling the city is, yes, consider making your land available for these types of projects. Consider doing that. But when you do that, the city, as part of that process, is supposed to evaluate what are the other potential long-range uses for this property. And here I have here, there is no evidence that the city took into consideration the full range of potential long-term uses for the 625 Winslow Way property. We have heard no testimony on that point. And in fact, what we have heard is we heard, for example, the testimony of Matthew Coates, who talked about other potential uses of this project. There are members of this community who think there are higher and better uses for this project. You can put an affordable housing project next door. You can put it anywhere else, but this particular very unique piece of property has a lot of different uses that can be put there, a lot of potential civic uses that could be put there. And there is zero evidence in the record that the city evaluated any other potential uses for this property, which is directly contrary to the implementation portion of the city's comprehensive plan, the housing element that it adopted pursuant to RCW 3670A070. What we do have, all we have, is this memo. This is the first mention of this housing project, which was on August 8th, 2023, when Mr. King wrote this memo. And all he reports is this is coming out of executive session that at the November 8th, 2022 and June 13th, 2023 city council meetings, the council directed staff to proceed with the redevelopment of city property at 625 Winslow Way, the current police department site, as an affordable housing project. They made a decision. There is no evidence that they actually complied with the one policy in the comprehensive plan that speaks to this particular issue. So I would say no. Regarding question one that Mr. Summing addressed, does this ordinance implement the housing element of the comprehensive plan under RCW 3670A070? The answer is no, it does not. They're violating the comprehensive plan. Question two, is this really a non-project proposal? And I think the answer is no, or at least the answer is not entirely. The ordinance is itself part and parcel. It is an integral part of the 625 Winslow Way project. Now, we spent a lot of time at the hearing talking about, well, what is the proposal that's on the table? And I raised that because the first quote here is from Exhibit A113. This is the Department of Ecology guidance on how to go about filling out an environmental checklist. And one of the very first things it says is, it says, do you have any plans for future additions, expansion, or further activity related to or connected with this proposal? If yes, explain. And then it says, define the total proposal by identifying known expansions, related proposals, connected project elements, or objectives. Then the next quote is from the Department of Ecology SEPA handbook, and it's and I highlighted this in the last oral argument to my own motion for judgment as a matter of law, and the handbook highlights that when you fill out the checklist, the most important thing, the very first thing that the city's supposed to do is to ask itself, is the project description complete? Have all interdependent pieces of the project been identified? Now, I do believe, and I think the city frankly agrees with us, and I'll point that out here in a moment, that this ordinance is part of the 625 project. The sole purpose of this ordinance is to enable that particular project. And yes, I think that implicates WAC 197.110603, which talks about when you have two different proposals, when they have to be united, when they have to be included in the very same environmental document, when they cannot be split apart for purposes of doing sort of different SEPA reviews at different times. And it says proposals or parts of proposals that are related to each other closely enough to be, in effect, a single course of action shall be evaluated in the same environmental document. Now, the second one here, B2, is are interdependent parts of a larger proposal and depend on the larger proposal as their justification or for their implementation. Well, I don't know how you can say that these aren't interdependent parts of a larger proposal. Back in 2022 and 2023, we just saw it on the screen, Exhibit A8, the City Council decided they were going to put an affordable housing project on this piece of property. And this particular ordinance is part of that, and the particular project plans they've been looking at as part of that. And there are two very definite project plans. There's a 90 unit and a 70 unit. Now, they may not know exactly which one they're going to adopt, but there's only two options, and they've been before the city council. We have the plans, right? I think it's right here. I mean, Mr. Soming asks, what's it going to look like? We know what it's going to look like, or at least we know how it's been proposed. We have very detailed plans. Mr. Coates testified these go way beyond conceptual plans, which is when you're supposed to do your SEPA review. So yes, the ordinance and the actual 625 project are one and the same. We saw it also when Mr. Soming walked Ms. Sutton through every parcel in the area where this ordinance applies and got her to say, nope, it's not going to apply there. And nope, it's not going to apply there, and didn't apply anywhere else. There was like one other small parcel that no one's ever talked about. No one's even said that there could be something there. The only parcel where this ordinance is going to apply is this particular parcel. It's been clear from day one. Everybody knows it. It was established even through Ms. Sutton's own testimony. Now, I say the city agrees with us, because they even said in their brief, we made the point of saying the ordinance talks about adoptions, amendments, decisions, those sorts of things, not just proposals. And they say, well, there was a decision. And they have, and I quote this out of the brief, they say, in the case at hand, the city council made a policy, quote, decision that is inextricably linked and underlies the challenged DNS. On August 19th, 2025, the city council, quote, directed the city manager to direct staff to come back with the tightest code change that makes sense to allow additional FAR for 100% affordable housing to facilitate the 625 Winslow Way affordable housing project. As a result of this council motion, staff prepared proposed ordinance 2025-21 and conducted the necessary SEPA review. By the city's own statements, it was that motion, a motion to prepare an ordinance for this project, that is the basis of the DNS. And that decision to facilitate this project, that is a project-level decision. That's a decision about a very particular construction project, a very particular housing project. And I have here the actual motion itself, that is what it was. It wasn't that the city wasn't first starting with an ordinance and saying, hey, let's propose an ordinance across the whole area. And then after we do the ordinance, decide on what projects to actually build. No, the decision was, let's facilitate this project. And as a way to get to this project, they told staff to come back with an ordinance. Now, that's important because the city's defense on this point in their brief is they say, well, we're doing phased review. They say, you know, you can we're actually doing it different phases. First, we're doing the ordinance, then we're going to do the project. Well, that's not how phased review works. First of all, it doesn't work. This is the rule on phased review, WAC 197.11.060 sub 5. First, it doesn't work because subsection 3 of this rule says you can't use phased review when it would segment and avoid present consideration of proposals and their impacts that are required to be evaluated in a single environmental document. Right? So you can't get out of the fact that you have to review actions that are so closely linked that they constitute, in effect, a single course of action. You can't get out of that through phased review. That's not how phased review works. And I guess one further point, you know, on this being a single course of action, you know, one of the exhibits I cited to you in my response and I submitted to you as a proposed exhibit, we didn't get to it last time, but I cited in my response, the city's plan, the city's original plan as late as September 12th. Of 2025, you know, Mr. King sent an email out saying, here's the order, we're going to do things. Well, their plan was to adopt the ordinance and approve this project on the very same day, at the same time. That was their plan. They were so closely linked. So you can't use phase review to get out of that. Not only that, you know, one of the things is it says here, phase review is not appropriate when the sequence is from a narrow project document to a broad policy document, right? Phased review applies when you start with a broad policy level ordinance that applies generally, and then you move from there to a particular project. That's what the rules say. Phased review doesn't work and it doesn't apply when you go the opposite direction. When your first decision is, let's do this project, and then in order to get there, you move to an ordinance. It only applies when you go from the ordinance to the project, not the project to the ordinance. And that's what the rule says. So I do, you know, the conclusion that I draw is RCW 4321C4954 only applies to the adoption of ordinances, rule, and other non-project actions. It does not purport on its face to apply to proposals that have a significant project level element. And the city, I don't think the city can validly invoke RCW 4321C495 sub 4 by frankly misrepresenting what the total proposal is that's on the table. Because the total proposal, the thing that they were supposed to identify in the checklist wasn't just an ordinance, it was the whole 625 Winslow project. And you can see here, that's even stated on the face of the checklist they filled out. This is from Exhibit A70. The instructions read, the checklist questions apply to all parts of your proposal, even if you plan to do them over a period of time or on different parcels of land. They're supposed to define the entirety of their proposal, and what they answered is not true. They were asked, do you have any plans for future additions, expansion, or further activity related to or connected with this proposal? Their answer was no. That is false. It's been false since day one. The correct answer would be, yes, this ordinance is being proposed specifically to enable and to facilitate the 625 Winslow project. And had they disclosed that, it would have been very clear that the total proposal included a major project element, and RCW 4321C4954 would not apply because it doesn't apply to any project level decisions or proposals. The next question I have, question number 3, is does RCW 4321C495 even apply to pre-decisional SEPA appeals? And, you know, I have here the rules. The general rule is SEPA appeals can only proceed, they can only be made after the, quote, underlying governmental action is taken, right? That's the general rule. You have to wait until the permit is issued. You have to wait until the ordinance is adopted before you're allowed to file your SEPA appeal. And then what you do is you challenge that action. And as part of your challenge to that action, you include a challenge to the SEPA review. That is categorically true for all appeals to state-level administrative tribunals, for example, the GMHB, and it's also true for all judicial appeals to Superior Court. However, SEPA does allow cities and counties at their discretion, they don't have to do this, they're completely free not to do this, but it allows them, if they choose, to provide for pre-decisional, pre-action SEPA appeals. And Bainbridge Island did that at BIMC 16.04.170. That's why we've been having this appeal for the past 6 months. It's because the city allows a pre-decisional, pre-action SEPA appeal where we can come in and challenge the DNS before the city actually takes action on what it's supposed to be evaluating. Now, the text of RCW 4321C 495, I think the words of the statute are important, in particular, the words adoption. It talks about the adoption of ordinances. It talks about the amendment of regulations and also says other non-project actions. But, you know, I don't think there's any dispute that the word adoption means actual legislative action. Amendment means actual legislative action. And non-project action also means actual legislative action, because if you look up the definition of non-project action in SEPA, it uses those same words. Non-project actions mean decisions on policies, plans, or programs. The adoption or amendment of legislation, the adoption or amendment of comprehensive land use plans, the adoption of policies, plans, and programs, or the creation of a district or annexations to any city. It's the actual action. And it makes sense for the statute to use those terms because the default rule is those are the things that trigger the ability to bring a SEPA appeal, because you can't bring a SEPA appeal beforehand unless the city or the county happens to choose to make that kind of appeal available. So it makes sense that that is why the statute would be phrased that way, because that's the default rule for how these appeals work. Now, the city in their brief says, well, WAC 197.11.704, the section I rely upon, the definition of the word non of the phrase non-project action, which is also the phrase that's used in the statute. They say, well, that section, quote, suffers from poor writing and a profound misunderstanding of the rules of grammar. That's from the city's brief. So as I read that, I'm not sure why that section that's been around for, I'm not even sure how long now, that we've all relied upon for a very long time. I'm not sure why it suffers from these things, but as I read it, the city's basically saying, well, it's not quite clear. Well, if it's not quite clear, then we look to other tools of statutory interpretation, such as legislative history. And this is a quote from the final Senate report on the bill that adopted RCW 4321C 495 sub 4. And this is the language that this that that the that the that the legislature used when they explained and when they said what this provision means. First of all, it's under the heading Appeals on Final Decisions. It gives you an indication, again, that, like as with the plain language of the statute, we're talking about appeals of final decisions. But then it's this paragraph right here that is especially important, because the legislature's summation is that adoptions of ordinances, development regulations, and other project actions by a city or county to implement housing element requirements are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under SEPA. And that sentence, where the legislature described and put in its own sort of words what the statute meant, the word adoptions applies or modifies the words ordinances, development regulations, and other non-project actions. That's the grammatical structure of that sentence. And that is consistent with the plain language of the statute, which is also that it's about adoptions, it's about amendments, it's about actually taking action. And that's actually throughout the entirety of RCW 4321C 495. You know, there's a maximum statutory interpretation that says words are known by the company they keep. To figure out what a particular phrase or word means, you look to the other words around it. And through that entire code section, it is focused on the actual taking of the underlying governmental action, the adoption of statutes. And that even goes back to its original conception in 2019 that Mr. Soeming referenced. When it was originally enacted, the wording of that section was that if these types of ordinances are adopted, if these types of non-project actions are taken by a certain date, you know, it was like, you know, April 19th, 2020. If they're actually done by that date, then they're immune. So it is both the language that exists now, it is the language as the legislature described it in the final Senate report, and it is back through history what the original intention of this was. All of it was about shielding the actual enactment or adoption of of ordinances, regulations, and other non-project actions from SEPA review. And that makes sense because that's when SEPA review normally occurs. So the answer to question number three, does it apply to pre-action or pre-decisional SEPA reviews? No, RCW 43321C.495 does not apply to pre-decisional SEPA appeals that are voluntarily adopted by cities and counties. If the city of Bainbridge Island wants to get rid of such appeals for any particular class of proposed actions, then it is more than free to do so. The legislature doesn't need to shield the city. The legislature doesn't need to do anything. The city itself can protect itself. It can simply amend the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code to take this cause of action away. They haven't. They've freely enacted it. And that's their right to do so. And the text of RCW 43321C 495 doesn't take it away. And so the punchline is, what the city put on the face of the DNS, that's what is accurate, which is right there on the screen, which is that they wrote on the face of the DNS, you may appeal this determination in accordance with the procedures set forth in BIMC 16.04.170. The final argument that I'd like to make for you, I made this. This is at my response at 9, note 34. This is an argument the city didn't respond to. And I posed the question, does RCW 43.21C.495 apply to ordinances affecting development in critical areas? And the reason why this comes up, and I'll get back to this, is that there's a separate, at the same time that RCW 43.21C.495 was adopted, the legislature also adopted this provision, which says the adoption of ordinances, development regulations, and amendments to such regulations that increase housing capacity, which I take it the city would argue this is, or increase housing affordability, which I take it the city argues this is, that apply outside critical areas are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals unless they adversely affect fish habitat. That sort of closely follows the first subsection of RCW 43.21C.495, which is the statute itself is sort of phrased interestingly. This first subsection, subsection one, where it says, the action specified in section two, chapter 246, laws of 2022, that is also referring to RCW 3678070, even though it's referring to the session law. But the point is, there's another section that says, well, if it applies to, to invoke these exceptions, it has to be outside a critical area. That's not stated on the face here, but it is stated elsewhere in another rule that the legislature has adopted. And that's relevant because the GMHB recently addressed that provision in in Port of Seattle versus City of Seattle. That was an ordinance by the city to allow residential development in the city's stadium transition overlay district. The appellants challenged it because the city just did zero SEPA review. That's sort of the danger of the statute, right? Is like the statute exempts the city from facing appeals. It doesn't actually exempt the city from doing SEPA review. And in that case, what had happened was the city of Seattle sort of took advantage of things and just did zero SEPA review. It's pretty similar to what happened here with doing the checklist after the actual decision was made. This is what happens is if you take away the appeals, there's a strong chance they just don't do anything. But the point is, in that case, the defendant raised RCW 43.21C.495 as a defense, and the GMHB said, no, this provision, although it has an exception for ordinances in critical areas, and because this one has an exemption for ordinances in critical areas, the SEPA appeal can still go forward. Well, in this case as well, Ordinance 2025-21 also affects development in a critical area, specifically a critical aquifer recharge zone. And we've raised that issue before you. We've talked about groundwater. Ms. Sutton testified that the groundwater management plan has been completed, hasn't actually been completed. There's a lot of concern about that. But the point is, based on this GMHB decision, I would submit to you that even though it's not stated on the face of RCW 43.21C.495 as the GMHB has interpreted it, if the ordinance authorizes development in a critical area, the SEPA appeal can still go forward. And that's what we have the case here. So my answer to that question is no, RCW 43.21C.495 does not apply to ordinances affecting development in critical areas. And my conclusions are fourfold. One, that the ordinance or the statute we're talking about does not apply because the city is violating its own comprehensive plan. It is not actually implementing the housing elements required by RCW 3670A070 sub 2, specifically because it's violating the one policy that talks about when the city makes its land available for affordable housing projects. It's supposed to consider other potential uses of the land, and the city never did that. It also doesn't apply because the city's total proposal, the thing that it was supposed to actually identify in the SEPA checklist, what it was supposed to be subject to environmental review, is not purely non-project. The total proposal is the 625 Winslow Way project, of which this ordinance is one part to facilitate. The only reason this ordinance is being proposed is in order to make that project a reality. And if the city had followed the instructions that are published by the Department of Ecology, that are published on the face of the checklist itself, they would have described the total proposal as including the 625 Winslow project. And that is not a non-project proposal. That is a project proposal. Third, the statute 4321C495 does not apply because this is a pre-decisional SEPA appeal voluntarily enacted by the Bainbridge Island City Council, and that is not something that is covered by the text of RCW 4321C.495. And we can tell that from the statute itself, from its history, from the Senate report that describes what it is that that statute applies to. Words are known by the company they keep, and all the words in the statute refer to actual action being taken, not merely a proposal. And finally, RCW 4321C.495 does not apply because the ordinance. Because this particular ordinance would allow increased development in a critical area. And under the GMHB case, I think Port of Seattle versus City of Seattle, there is an exception for that. And this appeal should be allowed to go forward. So my conclusion is the city's motion should be denied. Our motion for judgment as a matter of law should be granted because every piece of evidence that the city has come forward with has shown consistently that the checklist was not made until after the threshold determination was made in direct violation of SEPA. That is tantamount to not doing any SEPA review whatsoever. And so I would ask that the city's motion be denied. And if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them.
Okay, yeah, a few. Did I hear you correctly in saying that the SEPA statutes don't allow pre-decision SEPA appeals on permit applications? In other
No,
words, the city
what I had said
permit.
was, what I had said was decisions to state level tribunals and judicial appeals are need to be post-decisional.
Okay. But you are taking the position that for non-project actions, the SEPA appeal has to be done after the decision, after the ordinance is adopted, correct? For ordinance adoption.
At the Superior Court level of the GMHB, yes, that is correct. For state level tribunals and for Superior
Okay,
Court, that is
I thought
correct.
your major argument here was that you know 4321C 495 doesn't apply to this action because because the SEPA appeal is being considered before adoption of the ordinance as opposed to after.
Right, yeah. So the idea is in the ordinary course of events, right? So, the way SEPA works, as I understand it, is that the city of Bainbridge Island doesn't even have to have an internal SEPA appeal process. Like nothing requires it to do that, right? And if that doesn't happen, the way that you would get appealed is the city would ultimately adopt the ordinance, and then you would have to appeal the adoption of that ordinance, the GMHB, or if it was some other kind of action, whether it was a permit or whatever, you would appeal the actual action itself, the taking of the action, what SEPA itself refers to as the major action or the underlying action. You would appeal that to court or to a state level tribunal, right? But SEPA also says for cities and counties, at their discretion, they can adopt an internal SEPA appeal, right? And that SEPA appeal is allowed to go forward pre-decisional. And so that's why we're here, because in front of you, Mr. Examiner, the city has adopted a procedure that allows these to go forward before that ordinance is adopted. If the city hadn't done that, we would have to wait until after the ordinance is adopted. And that's what it says at, I believe it's RCW 4321C075, which is that SEPA appeal shall, without exception, be together with a challenge to the underlying action, unless unless it is the case that the city or the county or other agency chooses voluntarily to make a pre-decisional appeal route available within itself.
Okay, all right. Yeah, because I had understood your argument that it would apply if the city had an administrative appeal after it adopted its ordinance, which didn't seem to make much sense. You adopt an ordinance not knowing if you're going to lose an administrative appeal by your
Oh
own state.
no.
Okay.
I guess I mean so the default rule is SEPA appeals have to proceed, but I agree with you. I do agree with you that it wouldn't. I don't know if a city or county could have a post-decisional
Oh, that wouldn't make
appeal
it. Yeah.
on a permit, but no, they couldn't. I mean, it wouldn't really make much sense to have you sitting in review of an adopted
Yeah.
ordinance. But the underlying point is the city doesn't have to make any of this available. They've chosen to have a pre-decisional appeal. If they did away with that, they would just have to adopt it and then run their chances at the Superior Court
But
or the
let's
GMHB.
look at the language of subsection 4 here. It says at the end, are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter, under the SEPA chapter. So, I mean, isn't this saying that if you do elect to have an administrative SEPA appeal period and it involves an ordinance that implements your housing element, therefore it's not subject to that administrative appeal? I mean, it seems to be saying that in black and white right there.
Because it says are not subject to administrative or judicial
Yeah,
appeals
it
under this
mentions it
chapter.
includes administrative appeals, administrative SEPA appeals.
Yes, and so, so the question is, what is the class of things? What is the class of actions or proposals, whatever you want to call it? What is the class of things that are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter? I mean, I agree with you that the last clause is are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter, but you have to ask, what is the class of things that fall under that exception that are not going to be so subject to administrative appeals? And my argument to you is the class of things that are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter are the adoption of ordinances, which requires an actual adoption, the amendment of a regulation, which requires an actual amendment, or other non-project actions, because if you go look at the definition of non-project actions, those also refer to the adoption or the amendment. And so the entire structure of it is to shield it from post-adoption SEPA appeals, which kind of makes sense because what is the legislature thinking about, right? The legislature is thinking about the types of things that are ordinarily within the legislature's purview, which is who gets to go to the state level administrative tribunals like the GMHB, who gets to go to Superior Court, and that sort of thing. It's typically not within the legislature's purview to be worrying about who goes before a city hearing examiner, which is already at the city's own discretion. You know, no city in Washington has to make an appeal like this available. And so if we ask the question, what are the class of actions or whatever that are subject to not being judicially or administratively appealed under SEPA, that class involves the actual taking of actions, the adoptions of ordinances,
Yeah.
the amendments or the taking of non-project actions.
But, you know, I mean, as I'm sure you'll agree, the fundamental purpose of SEPA is informed decision making. And when you're dealing with ordinances, the SEPA review of ordinances, which is what the statute addresses, the SEPA review of an upcoming final decision on an ordinance is your SEPA checklist and all that stuff that's done before the ordinance is adopted. And so that could include the administrative appeal that the city has adopted as part of that SEPA review process. I mean, yeah, adoption of ordinances, yeah, that final decision, that's what the statute addresses, but it addresses the SEPA review associated with that final adoption of an ordinance, which has to be done before the ordinance is adopted, because of course we have to have our SEPA information before the decision is made. So I don't know.
I would love to answer that question,
Yeah.
Mr. Examiner, but I do have to admit I don't quite understand it. So
Okay.
I understand that before the ordinance is adopted, the SEPA review must occur, right? And the SEPA review is supposed to inform the local city council or le the legislative body, their decision on the ordinance. I understand that. I understand that the end clause, and I'll put it on the screen so we can both talk about it and point to it if need be. Here, I mean, I can blow this up. So I understand that the last clause is that the things talked about in the first clause are not subject to administrative or judicial appeals. And I understand that the thing that is not subject to, so, or I guess, is your question maybe When we ask the question, what is not subject to administrative or judicial appeals under this chapter? When we ask that question, do you believe that the disconnect between what I'm saying and what you are saying might be that I'm talking about the ordinance being subject to administrative or judicial appeals, whereas you're talking about the CEPA review being subject to administrative or judicial appeals under
Yeah,
CEPA?
and then when it mentions the administrative appeal, that's the appeal of the CEPA review of that ordinance, and therefore not subject to appeal if it deals with the.
I think I think I okay. I think I understand, and I think that. And with all due respect, I think that perhaps the way that you're thinking about it may not be entirely accurate. And I think this comes out of the section of CEPA, and I can pull it up on my screen. Let me see here. When we talk about what is subject to review under CEPA, when we look at the appeal provision of CEPA, let me see here.
Yeah, and maybe one way you could answer it is just give me an example of an administrative CEPA appeal re related to an ordinance that wouldn't be allowed to go forward under this statute.
Any appeal to the GMHB, any appeal in Superior Court,
That's not an administrative appeal. Oh, I see. You're thinking of
to the
administrative.
GMHB is 100% to an
Of
is an
course. Oh,
administrative
okay.
appeal.
Well, maybe that's our disconnect, because I'm thinking administrative
Yeah,
is the whole
no,
thing.
because see, no, and in fact, the GMHB is. I mean, my understanding is the GMHB has held this, right? Because administrative, because the rules that apply to the GMHB, they're a state level agency, is the Washington APA, and they're under the provisions for administrative appeals. And so that's what I'm saying is that when it and in fact, the other section I showed you that was about RC, it was at RCW 3670A 0702H. Right, that was talking about primarily to the GMHB, and there it also uses the phrase administrative appeals, right? And so my point is, when the legislature is talking about administrative or judicial appeals, well, what's the legislature thinking about? Number one, what the legislature is thinking about, given the phrase, is it's thinking about the default rule, which is that you can't bring an appeal anywhere, be it to a state level agency or to a court, until the actual action is taken, right? And so what they're referring to here is the things that are normally within the legislature's purview, which is, appeals to higher to well, agencies and courts that aren't basically at the level we're at right now, which is at the municipal level.
I mean, how do you come to the conclusion administrative doesn't include local appeals? Because, as you know, like 197.11.680, which deals with local appeals, I believe, references them as administrative
No,
appeals.
this is also an administrative appeal. So there's two questions, right? There one is what is the class of actions that fall that are shielded or protected, right? And then what are they shielded from, right? And my argument to you is the things that are shielded or protected are the actual adoptions of ordinances, in effect, the taking of actions. And that flows out of the fact that ordinarily you never allowed to bring a CEPA appeal until after that action is taken anyways. That's the default rule under CEPA, right? And then what those things are shielded from is any and all administrative or judicial appeal that is basically challenging the adoption of that ordinance or the taking of that action from a CEPA from any form of CEPA appeal in before an agency or a court. What it doesn't apply to, in my theory, is CEPA appeals that occur before that decision is made, right? And the natural reason for that is because A, those appeals all take place at this level, at the municipal level. They're not, I mean, maybe there's an agency out there that allows a CEPA appeal beforehand. I'm not aware of one, but they're primarily, municipal level pre-decisional CEPA appeals. And we can tell that because, again, words are known by the company they keep. It's not just non-project actions, but you have to look at the whole statute. In fact, the title is RCW 4321C.495, Adoption of Ordinances, Development Regulations, and Other Non-Project Actions, right? So the title, every section in the ordinance talks about the adoption of ordinances and development regulations. The entire sort of gestalt of the ordinance or of the statute is all about shielding final actions from CEPA reviews, right? That's my argument, and that's bolstered, I think, by legislative history and whatnot. But I also don't think that this is, I mean, I think it's right, but it's also not a make or necessarily make or break, because I do also very much believe, as I pointed out, that they aren't actually implementing the comprehensive plan, because they're violating a very important part of it. And number two, you know, if I mean, I do think you have to look at the total proposal. I mean, SEPA says you have to define the total proposal, and you shouldn't be allowed to take umbrage under this particular statute if what you're doing is hiding a major part of your proposal, which doesn't fit, right?
Okay, and so, but I, it does look like we agree that what's at issue here is, as Mr. Soaming said, this subsection 4 applies to ordinances, development regs, amendments, and non-project actions. You're looking at the ordinance part, right? We're trying to decide if the reference to ordinances applies to this particular appeal. Is that correct? Because Mr. Soaming, I think, is taking the position it's under the non-project action category.
Yeah, well, so I think it's a little more nuanced. I mean, I do think it's significant that the one place where the specific type of action we're talking about here, which is ordinances, right? I mean, I do think it's significant that when it mentions ordinances, it's specifically the adoption of ordinances, right? So you know, but then it does say other non-project actions, right? And my point to you is, well, if you go look at the definition of non-project action, it uses the same language. It says adoption of, amendment of, that sort of thing. Now, what I do understand Mr. Soaming to be saying, and you know, I guess, let me just pull it up here. What I understand Mr. Soaming to be saying is, if you look at the definition of non, well, you know, I cited this section, the definition of non-project action, and I pointed out that, you know, the definition of a non-project action talks about actual actions being taken, right? The adoption or the amendment, a decision being made, the actual thing that normally would trigger CEPA review, not you know, not something pre-decisional, right? That's what I pointed out in my brief. And then my understanding is he said, well, that section suffers from a profound misunderstanding of the rules of grammar. And then he said, instead of looking at the definition of non-project action, which is the actual phrase used in the statute, he said, rather than look at that, you should look up here where it just says actions generally. And he points out that under actions generally, it does mention legislative proposals, right? Now, I guess my retort to that would be, this particular part right here where it says legislative proposals, that's kind of an outlier. Right. I mean, and I say that because, you know, SEPA talks about, for any major action affecting the environment, you have to do environmental review. The rules of the appellate procedure under SEPA talk about the, you know, you have to challenge SEPA with the underlying governmental action, right? Everywhere else in SEPA where it uses the word action, it's talking about the actual thing that you're adopting, the actual taking of the action. Because a proposal, for example, if you were to read SEPA, where it says all, you know, for any major action affecting the environment, you have to do SEPA review. Well, that can't be talking about a proposal, because I mean, a proposal itself doesn't affect the environment, right? It's the actual taking of the action. So my argument would be, you know, if there's any part of the statute that's sort of off, that doesn't quite fit, it's this part right here where it's talking about an action being a legislative proposal. It doesn't quite fit how SEPA, by and large, uses the word action. Everywhere else, when it uses the word action, it's talking about, you know, the adoption of an ordinance, the issuance of a permit, that sort of thing. And you see that reflected in the definition of non-project action, which again is the phrase that's used in the statute. And then again, if you look at the statute itself and you think about the idea that words get their meaning from the company they keep, you know, the only potential ambiguity is in, well, what is the word non-project action mean? If you look at the whole rest of the statute, it's all about adoption and amendments, the actual taking of the action you're evaluating. And then at the end of that process, if you think, well, geez, it still seems kind of ambiguous, that's when you turn to legislative history and you ask, okay, well, what did the legislature actually say about it? And what the legislature actually said about it in legislative history, when they phrased it in their own words and they said, here's what it means, they wrote it in a way which very clearly tells you, no, it's about the actual adoptions of ordinances, development regulations, and other non-project actions. You know, that's what they're talking about here. So I guess my point is, I think that Mr. Soaming's point about, you know, what is an action kind of ignores the text of the actual provision we're talking about. It ignores the overall sort of structure and wording of the greater section. It ignores the title of the section and it ignores legislative history. That's a whole lot to hang on one little phrase in SEPA that seems to go against everything else.
One final question. So, if 4321C 495(4) doesn't apply to local administrative appeals, are you going to run into circumstances then where the city can has a local administrative appeal and then that can't be appealed judicially or to the Growth Management Hearings Board?
We ran into this problem with the city's first motion to dismiss. And I forget exactly how it was, but there was an issue where, I remember expressing to you the idea that, oh, this is what it was. I remember there was a standing issue that Mr. Soeming had raised, right? And I had pointed out that there are certain rules for standing at the Superior Court level, and that other cities and cities and counties have taken pains in their own codes to say what you have to do to have standing to bring a local administrative appeal to a city or county hearing examiner. And I had pointed out that the city of Bainbridge Island, their code just said any person can do it, right? And I guess the point that I tried to get across to you then was that even if you don't think that your decision can necessarily be appealed, or that my client couldn't go further, I would urge you not to rely on that as a reason for kicking us out. I mean, even if you're sort of the sole potential adjudicator, right, of the validity of the city's DNS, I would urge you to take that on, and because that's whether we can go further or not doesn't take away from the fact that we're validly before you today, and we're asking for your help and for your decision.
Yeah.
But
Well, it's
I also don't know the answer to that question because, for example, if you were to say, "I don't think I have jurisdiction," I think on that I could go to Superior Court and say, "No, the examiner wrongly interpreted his own jurisdiction. I'm not asking you, Superior Court, to rule on the validity of the DNS, but I do want to remand back with instructions for the Bainbridge Island hearing examiner to actually address the merits of that action."
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, I don't think that necessarily means you can't have a process that's not appealable. I think there was a Snohomish County case that essentially held that docketing decisions on comp plan amendments are not subject to appeal. It just ends right there, So it's happened. It's kind of useful information in trying to figure out if you have some ambiguity in the law, sometimes you look at the logic of the process, and that's just another piece of the puzzle to see if it's logical or not.
Yeah, and I think the fundamental logic, though, I think the fundamental logic is, like the city of Bainbridge Island, the state has certain goals, and the city is supposed to implement those in its comprehensive plan, and the city can't do anything to not be hauled in to say that it's hauled before the GMHB or hauled into court. It's sort of powerless in that. Right, like it, like I, if I wanted to, right, without this law, I could just force the city to come meet me in court, right, or I could force the city to come meet me in the GMHB, and so the legislature has taken that power away from me, and it's given that to the city, but the city already has the power to protect itself from its own hearing examiner. It already has that freedom, and it already has that authority. It does not have to have this procedure, and so why would it even be right that the legislature would go in there and take away the city's own freedom and take away the city's own authority when the city itself can get rid of that itself, but you know what the city can also do? The city, like you said, this appeal is kind of like part of that SEPA process, right? The city itself might actually think that appeals like this are a good idea. It might actually think that appeals like this are actually a good way of making sure that its decisions are informed, and a good way of actually doing those sorts of things. And so the city goes and it enters a contract and it hires a person like you who is very knowledgeable about the law, and it has you conduct these sort of proceedings. I mean, it's terribly expensive, it's terribly time consuming, but it is in fact a good way of making sure that the city has reached a good result. And so why would the legislature take that away from the city if the city wants to do that, and the city can do it on an appropriate timeline? Why is that? And my argument to you is, I don't think the legislature has. I think the legislature was primarily concerned with making sure that entities like the City of Bainbridge Island are not hauled against their will to entities like the GMHB and the courts. It didn't actually go and take away the city's freedom to make this kind of proceeding available. And I think you see that reflected all over the place in the language of sub four, in the overall structure and language of 495, and the title of 495 in the legislative history, and even as Mr. Soeming had talked about in the original adoption back in 2019, which was all about if you actually adopt these regulations by a date certain, we're going to give you a shield. And then they sort of took that and extended it through time.
Okay, sounds good. Makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Mr. Telgen.
Thank you so much.
All right, back to you, Mr. Soeming. Final words.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Examiner. All right. So, Mr. Telgen made a lot of interesting points. I think I'm going to try to summarize my rebuttal in about seven or eight different points. Point number one, Ordinance 2521 implements the city's comprehensive plans, goals, and policies for affordable housing. Now, with respect to this argument, the appellant kind of hyper-focused on the comprehensive plan as it exists now, Policy 9.5, and says essentially, look, the city is in violation of this particular policy because it didn't consider any other options. Therefore, how can Ordinance 25-21 implement the comprehensive plan? I think first and foremost, I think it's important to kind of redirect the hearing examiner's attention to all the other policies and goals that I cited within the city's briefing, as well as I cited earlier today, goal HO1, HO4, policy 4.2, 4.5, goal HO6. Those all clearly mandate the city to do its best to increase affordable housing throughout the city. But second, and more directly to policy 9.5, if I saw it correctly, policy 9.5 requires essentially the city to consider other options, and actually, with respect to city-owned properties. And that's actually what the city did. My understanding, and we haven't completed our hearing, my understanding is the city did actually evaluate other options, including sale of the property. So I would argue that the city is not in violation of the comprehensive plan. Ordinance 2521 does kind of implement those other previously mentioned goals and policies. That's point number one. Point number two, the proposal here is Ordinance 25-21. It's not Ordinance 2521 and the 625 project. It's not Ordinance 2521 with, the 65 project embedded in it, within it. It's separate and distinct from the project. This is illustrated by the fact, again, that one, the proposal has really evolved over time, and the parameters have really changed. Mr. Telgen brought up the testimony of, I believe it's Mr. Coates, who looked at the most recent plans that Lehigh submitted to the city, or showed to the city, and said, and Mr. Coates simply said, this is beyond conceptual. But simply because this is beyond conceptual doesn't mean that things can change down the line. We have no project permit applications. There are no guarantees that this project will be X amount of feet high, will have this amount of FAR, this amount of parking, this kind of bulk. The project isn't even fully financed. So there's really not a lot that the city can do in meaningful environmental analysis on. Point number three, and perhaps this is, I'll admit, due to perhaps a little bit of imprecise brief writing. To clarify, the city's reply did not necessarily admit that in this case, phase was conducting phase review. If you kind of go back and read the city's brief, I think it's actually pretty clear if you parse it out that we never admitted that. And instead, the city merely cited the phase review point in its briefing to simply illustrate that the CEPA rules in general contemplate that agencies have to determine the appropriate scope and level of detail environmental review to coincide with meaningful points in their planning and decision-making process. That's point number three. Point number four. The appellant's argument with respect to RCW 4321C does not apply to proposals with significant project-level element is wrong for two reasons. One, it's simply not supported by the plain language of the statute. If you read that language of the statute, it's clear. It doesn't say anything about significant project-level situations. It just simply says non-project. It says what it says. And second, the appellant's argument kind of misses the fact, again, that the legislature enacted 4321C 4954 to speed up affordable housing projects with the clear recognition that project-based SEPA will still be conducted down the line. Now, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, we always kind of say that slightly jokingly, slightly not, but must have realized that, if you take away appeals of non-project-based SEPA for affordable housing, there will still be an opportunity for project-based SEPA. There will still be opportunities for appeal at that point, still opportunity for environmental review. And they didn't do that here. They just took away kind of that non-project-based level. So I think the fact that they did not take away that the right or the fact that cities have to do project-based review, that appeals of project-based review are still entitled, really kind of undercuts that argument that we should read language about significant project level elements within 4320C 4954. I believe that was point number four. Point number five. Interpreting 4321C 4954 to allow cities to have appeals on non-project actions that implement 3670-0702 frustrates the purpose of the statute. I'll kind of get this later as I'm wrapping this up. But interpreting it that way will allow non-project actions to increase housing to essentially slow despite clear intent to speed it up. The city in its initial motion had cited to the hearing examiner adoptive language that was actually adopted by the state legislature in a bill that clearly indicates the purpose is to increase affordable housing. Point number five. Point number six. The appellant also relied upon RCW 4321C 4954 Senate bill to kind of bolster its position. First, I think that runs contrary to the express purpose of the statute. Again, the city cited language that was adopted by the state legislature that says that this is all about increasing housing. If you were to rely upon that Senate bill report, I think that runs contrary to it. And second, the Senate bill, as I noted in the city's reply, the Senate bill clearly states that it should not be relied upon for legislative history. According to the final bill report for ESS B5148, the analysis in the report says it is not a part of the legislation, nor does it constitute a statement of legislative intent. So I think that clearly dispatches that. Point number seven. RCW 3670A0702H and RCW 4321C 4954, in the city's opinion, constitute separate SEPA appeal exemptions. If you look at the language of the relevant part of 3670A0702H and compare it to 4321C 4954, they are, while similar, they are very different languages. And when you take into consideration that it is based on my research and my understanding that the relevant part of 3670A0702H was adopted roughly in 2023. That was 2 years before RCW 4320C 4954 was adopted. So how could these two provisions be one and the same? I think the fact that, that they were adopted by two separate times really shows that they were not. And to the extent that they may overlap, we have to consider that the most recent legislative action here, which is the adoption of 4954, is the most recent is the most specific expression of legislative intent. So to kind of bring it all home, Mr. Obrecht, I think one term that you used in your questions you asked, which intelligent, kind of really jumped out to me, and that is logic of the process. We're fighting over interpretation of 4321C 4954, and the courts have really said that the clearest expression of legislative intent is the words. And while the city contends that the words does support its motion for dismissal due to lack of subject matter jurisdiction, when you look at the legislative intent, again cited in the city's motion, it really kind of underscores the city's argument, and that is the clear purpose of 4954 is a recognition that housing is really needed in the state, in this region. And despite multiple attempts in consecutive years, affordable housing simply hasn't been developed. And in a clear effort to remove barriers That's why they adopted 4954. There are a lot of barriers, we call that broadly, barriers to building affordable housing, whether that is economic or legislative or whatnot. And one of the clearest barriers to development affordable housing is CEPA review. The legislature looked at the CEPA review process and said, look, there are two opportunities for a CEPA review if potentially up to two, if a affordable housing project were to be built. One, potentially at the non-project level, and two, at the project level. And they said to themselves, these CEPA reviews take an immense amount of time, and it slows projects, it delays projects, it kills projects. So let's expedite the process. Let's remove one hurdle in the form of CEPA review, appeals to CEPA review on non-project actions, while leaving the other clear procedural barrier or guardrail, which is project-based CEPA, in place. This way, we can expedite things. So that is really the logic of the process here. And when you keep that in mind, and you look at how 4954 is written with the definitions from the CEPA rules, I think you will truly see that the city's motion for lack of subject matter jurisdiction should be granted. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Telgen had also raised the argument that since development could occur in or affect critical areas, that this wouldn't apply. Do you have any response to that argument?
I kind of touched on that, and perhaps in an eloquent way. So if you look at RCW 3670A 0702H, there's actually quite a bit under it. I think it's one of the paragraphs that states in part, adoption of ordinances, development regulations, and amendments to such regulations, and other non-project actions taken by that city that is required to choose to plan under 3670040 that increase housing capacity, increase housing affordability, and mitigate displacement as required by subsection 2, and that apply outside critical areas, are not subject to administrative or judicial appeal, and so forth. I read that as a separate and distinct exemption from exemption from CEPA
No, I
appeals,
see. Okay.
as established in 4321C 4954. Again, 2H was adopted years before than 4954. The language is completely different. I think we must look at the strict language of 4954 to apply the clearest intent of the legislature.
I mean, would there be any critical areas affected by this project? I mean, where the 625 project is located, are there
Well,
critical?
I believe, as noted, I think it was in Mr. Telligence, slides, that the city has a is entirely designated critical aquifer recharge area, I believe is what it is. And I believe that's what he was citing.
Yeah, in the case I cited, it was a liquefaction prone area.
Okay, got it. All right. Okay, well, I have to admit, I was a little skeptical of how much we would gain from the oral argument, but actually quite a bit, I think. So I'm glad we did it. That really helped clarify the issues for me quite a bit. So, I'm gonna shoot for getting this ruling out in about a week, I think. I mean, I've got some other big decisions before, but I think I can do it in a week probably. We don't have the continued hearing date. Do you want to just wait till my ruling and then figure out a date for the hearing? Would that be the easiest thing to do?
I think that makes most amount of sense. Yeah, I think my witnesses are getting, unfortunately, a lot of whiplash from me, and
Okay.
I, obviously, depending on how you rule on the city's motion to dismiss, then you may need to address their motion for judgment as a matter of law. And
Too
I
many
don't
rules.
know if you plan on dealing with them consecutively. So I think perhaps it's best to set it after you make a decision that requires us to continue the
Yeah.
hearing, if that makes sense.
And where were we on, because I'm sort of outside of how the city provides notice for the actual hearing itself. I mean, I had been kind of assuming, it doesn't mean the city was doing it wrong, but normally for these hearings, when they're continued and we decide to continue it further, you still, on the day that it was originally scheduled, put up a little sign at the Zoom link saying this hearing has been continued to X date. And apparently, Bainbridge Island hasn't been doing that, I don't think. So the public has no idea. Theoretically, the public could, that was interested enough to participate in the hearing, would go to the next scheduled hearing date, see the sign saying it's continued to another date, and then they would know what date to go to. Since that wasn't done in this case, I'm wondering, do we have to re-advertise the public hearing if we move forward? Or I mean, maybe that's just something for you to think about, Mr. Selming, but it's I mean, it's kind of analogous to the Open Public Meetings Act. You know, if you continue your hearing, you don't have to republish it if you post the notice of the continued hearing date on the door. I think that same kind of logic applies to a public hearing that's advertised. If the public has no indication of when the next continued hearing date is because that was done by email, you know, I think you might have to at least provide public notice about the continued hearing date at that point.
I
Does that make sense,
believe,
what I'm saying?
yeah, I understand what you're saying, and you know, I don't mean to speak for City South, but I believe the city has been advertising, or at least not advertising, noticing the continuation of the hearing online at the very least.
Okay.
You know, obviously, since we're not in person, noticing is a little hard. You know, you can't put it on a door, you can't put it on a virtual Zoom door, I suppose. But I
Okay.
believe the city has been doing that, but I will certainly inquire with city staff and follow up.
Yeah, I'll just
Thank
leave it for you to figure that out, but it's something to do
They're
around.
going to put it in the Kitsap Sun.
Yeah, there you go. Do that. So whatever works. Okay. So yeah, like I said, I'm shooting then for by next Tuesday and maybe even before, and then we'll take it from there. So good arguments today.
Thanks
All
for
right.
answering, Mr. Olbrechts.
Yeah, thanks. We're adjourned. See you
Bye.
next time.
Thank you.